जय राधा माधव कुंज विहारी। जय गोपी जनवल्लभा गिरिवरधारी। गोपी जनवल्लभा गिरिवरधारी। यशोदनन्दन व्रजजन रञ्जन यशोदनन्दन व्रजजन रञ्जन जमुना तीरावनचारी। जामुना तेरावनचारी। जय राधा माधव कुंज विहारी। जय राधा माधव कुंज विहारी। जय ओम विष्णुपाल परमहंसा परिव्राजाकाचार्य शतशतशी श्रीमद हिज डिवाइन ग्रेस शिल एसी भक्तिवेदांत स्वामी श्रील प्रभुपाद की अनंत कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की। हरे कृष्ण। टुडे वी आर रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 5 चैप्टर 10। वी रीड टेक्स्ट 24 एंड 25। सो वी चैंट द श्लोक फॉर 24 एंड देन आई विल आल्सो रीड द जस्ट द इंग्लिश एंड द परपोर्ट फॉर 25 एज़ वेल। So I'll chant the shlok first, and then we can take turns chanting. And if it's possible, I have a request. Can everyone just move up a little bit? Especially the Matajis, the sound is a little bit difficult with the rain. So if everyone can just come forward a little bit, if you're able to. If not, no problem. And when we chant the Sanskrit, for those who would want to chant, we will alternate. So we can have the men, then the women, then the men, the women, like that. Okay. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Text 24. Tanme Bhavanara Deva Bhimana. मदेन तुच्छीकृत सत्तमस्य कृषिष्ट मैत्री दृशम आर्त बंदो यथा तरेषद् अवध्यानम् अम्हाः। Tanme bhavana radeva bhimana. Madena tucci krita sattamasya. Krishishta maitri drisham artha bandho. Yattatare sad avadhyanam amaha. Tanme bhavana radeva bhimana. Madena tucci krita sattamasya. Krishishta maitri drisham artha bandho. Yattatare sad avadhyanam amaha. Tanme bhavana radeva bhimana. Madhena tucci krita sattamasya. Krishishta maitri drisham artha bandho. Yathātare sad avadhyānam amha. Anme bhavānara. Tucci krita sattamasya. Krishishta maitrihi drisham artha bandho. Yathātare sad. Anme bhavana radeva vimana. Yathātare sad avadhyānam amha. Anyway. Tanme bhavana radeva bhimana. Madena tucci krita sattamasya. Krishnam artha bandho. Anyone else? Tanme bhavana radeva bhimana. Madena tucci krita sattamasya. Krishista maitri drisham artha bandho. Yathātare.
Krishishta maitri drisham artha
So we'll skip the word for word in the interest of time because we have two verses today. So I'll just read the translation, the purport, and then the next translation and purport. Translation, whatever you have spoken appears to me to be contradictory. This is Maharaj Rahugana speaking. O best friend of the distressed, I have committed a great offense by insulting you. I was puffed up with false prestige due to possessing the body of a king. For this, I have certainly become an offender. Therefore, I pray that you kindly glance at me with your causeless mercy. If you do so, I can be relieved from sinful activities brought about by insulting you. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has said that by offending a Vaishnava, one finishes all his spiritual activities. Offending a Vaishnava is considered the mad elephant offense. A mad elephant can destroy an entire garden which has been developed with great labor. One may attain the topmost platform of devotional service, but somehow or other, if he offends a Vaishnava, the whole structure collapses. Unconsciously, King Rahugana offended Jad Bharat, but due to his good sense, he asked to be excused. This is the process by which one can be relieved from a Vaishnav aparad. Krishna is always very simple and by nature merciful. That's such an amazing, I want to read that again. It's such an amazing sentence. This is what Prabhupada says. Krishna is always very simple and by nature merciful. Can you just imagine the quality of our bhakti if every day we can just remember this one sentence? Krishna is always very simple and by nature merciful. When one commits an offense at the feet of a Vaishnav, one must immediately apologize to such a personality so that his spiritual advancement may not be hampered. And then I'll read the next text as well. Again, translation. Oh, my dear Lord, you are the friend of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the friend of all living entities. You are therefore equal to everyone, and you are free from the bodily conception. Although I have committed an offense by insulting you, I know that there is no loss or gain for you due to my insult. You are fixed in your determination, but I have committed an offense. Because of this, even though I may be as strong as Lord Shiva, I shall be vanquished without delay due to my offense at the lotus feet of a Vaishnav. Jai Shishi Radha Vrindavan Bihari Gauranga Mahaprabhu Ki Jai. Purport. Maharaj Rahugana was very intelligent and conscious of the inauspicious effects arising from insulting a Vaishnav. He was therefore very anxious to be excused by Jad Bharat. Following in the footsteps of Maharaj Rahugana, everyone should be very cautious not to commit an offense at the lotus feet of a Vaishnav. Srila Vrindavan Das Thakur in the Chaitanya Bhagavat has said, even if one is as strong as Lord Shiva, who carries a trident in his hand, one will nonetheless fall down from his spiritual position if he tries to insult a Vaishnav. This is the verdict of all Vedic scriptures. He also says this in Chaitanya, in another place in Chaitanya Bhagavat, Madhya 22. He says, one who blasphemes a Vaishnav cannot be protected by anyone. Even if a person is as strong as Lord Shiva, if he blasphemes a Vaishnav, he is sure to be destroyed. This is the verdict of all Shastra. If one does not care for the verdict of the Shastra and dares blaspheme a Vaishnav, he suffers life after life because of this. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 5th canto, 10th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Discussion Between Jad Bharat and Maharaj Rahugana. Om Agyanti Mrandasya Gyananjana Shlakhaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Maha Namashestam Manumapim Sachi Putram Atara Surupam Rupam Tasya Graja Urupurim Maturim Goshtavatim Radha Krishna Radha Kundam Girivaram Aho Radhika Madhavasam Praptoyasya Pratita Kripaya Shri Gurum Tam Natosmi. I like this Mangalacharan when I'm in the eco-village. It very much reminds me. This is a beautiful prayer. It says that I bow down to the beautiful lotus feet of my spiritual master, by whose mercy I've obtained so many treasures. I've obtained the holy name. I've obtained the service of the son of Sachimata, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. By the mercy of the lotus feet of my spiritual master, I've attained the treasure of the association of Srila Swarup Damodar, of Rupa Goswami, and of his brother Sanatan Goswami. I've attained the supreme abode of Mathura, the blissful abode of Vrindavan, and the divine Radhakund and Govardhan. And the desires within my heart for the loving service of Sri Sri Radhika and Madhava in Vrindavan are fulfilled. Hare Krishna. So I'm very honored and delighted to be back home, back in Govardhan Eco Village. I very much consider this holy place and community my home. Home away from home, maybe one day home. And just speaking here is always a humbling experience, but an inspiring experience and a purifying experience. So I'm just trying to share something for my own purification, but asking for the blessings of all the Vaishnavas. These verses conclude the chapter in which Maharaj Rahugana has now realized his mistake and is coming to his senses and seeking forgiveness. What was Maharaj Rahugana's mistake? In one sense, it was a very common mistake that all of us make. He judged quickly. He judged externally. He jumped to a conclusion. And as Srila Prabhupada points out in the purport, and actually as Maharaj Rahugana speaks in the verse itself, he became so fixated on his position in relation to this position of another that he used that as the lens through which he related to this person without knowing the full story. And this is, we're not kings being carried on palanquins, but this is something we can all relate to, I think. I want to confess something, a story. I mean, there's so many examples in my own life, but I want to share one today. I haven't really shared it publicly so much. But maybe 20 years ago, I had an episode or a situation. My wife and I were engaged in working with the youth in our communities. We're still trying to do that a little bit, but we're getting too old now. But at that time especially, we were working very closely with youth. And there was one young man, like a boy, maybe 15, 16 years old, who was just starting to come, starting to get introduced to Krishna consciousness. And somehow or other, this boy took a liking to me. But he was a little, like, quirky personality. Do you know this word quirky here? Yeah, like a little eccentric, a little different. His ideas were a little different. He was kind of interested in some things. We'd be doing one thing, and he'd be just in the corner of the room doing something else. So he's a little, like we say in America, a little weird. And he had many ideas of how he wanted to contribute to Krishna consciousness, to serving Krishna and to, you know, spreading Krishna consciousness. And I was myself in my 20s, quite immature myself, but really kind of in this bhav of I'm like the youth leader, and I was initiated, I think maybe second initiated by that point, and very much in this bhav. I'd done my bhakti shastri, so I thought I was a great, you know, pandit or shastri or something. And I really, somehow I just couldn't appreciate this boy. Even though he was so affectionate towards me, I was always like heavying him out. You know this old ISKCON expression, heavying out. I was always like being kind of heavy with him, you know, trying to get him in line with the other youth. And he had this idea for a project. And very humbly, actually, very sweetly and humbly, he was asking me for some help, and he really wanted to do this project. And I just couldn't understand. I thought it was completely unrealistic project. I thought, you know, you're just a kid. What are you going to do? You're trying to do this ambitious thing. You should just concentrate on, you know, your sadhana, studying shastra, like that. Somehow or other, by Krishna's arrangement, I think he moved away or something, but we lost touch. And it was only years later that I reconnected, not just with him, but with this project that he had created. So this project that he created was a website that is a repository for all the Vaishnava bhajans that we have. It's called KK Songs. Some of you know KK Songs. So even today, anywhere in ISKCON, someone's giving a class, someone's singing a bhajan, what does everyone do on their mobile phones? Everyone immediately goes, KK Songs, KK Songs, looks it up. So how many lives this person impacted, and he's continuing to impact. What a service he's doing to all Vaishnavas. What an amazing gift to our whole tradition, right? He put together this whole thing. He learned all these bhajans. He educated himself. He didn't come from a music background. He didn't come from Bengali. He learned Bengali. He learned all these different rags and thals and all of this. His heart, that was what he was actually inspired to do. Krishna was inspiring him, but I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it at all. And so like that, that's just one story, but there's so many stories where we're so fixed in our own positions, we're so fixed in our own version of reality, and we just can't see the way Krishna can see. So I want to ask everyone to just close your eyes, just for a minute. We'll go on, but just for a minute, just close your eyes. I'll keep my eyes open so I can see if you're closing them or not. So please, everyone, close your eyes. And just think of one or two, maybe, incidents from your own life where you were in a similar situation, where maybe somehow or other you misjudged another Vaishnava, you took them for granted. Or maybe you've had a situation the other way, where someone, perhaps you got the feeling that another Vaishnava was maybe judging you too quickly. And now I want you to think about how you reacted or responded to that situation. And maybe, for some of us, how you wish you responded or reacted. Thank you. You can open your eyes. So I want you to keep this in mind. We're going to talk a little bit. The time is going so quickly. We're going to talk a little bit, and I really want to focus on one point that Prabhupada makes in these two purports. In these purports, he emphasizes two things, as far as I can see. One is the danger of Vaishnava Aparad. You saw that especially in the second purport. And the other thing that he emphasizes, does anyone want to say? What did you notice? What is Prabhupada emphasizing? Yeah. Begging for, even and especially immediately begging forgiveness. That probably, maybe you can keep the mic because I'll try to make it a little interactive. So I want to focus, there's so many wonderful lectures on the dangers of Vaishnava Aparad, but I want to especially focus on this idea of the need to seek forgiveness, and especially if at all possible. Sometimes it's not possible, the situation may be such that it's not possible immediately, but as far as possible, immediately, as quickly, as swiftly as possible to seek forgiveness. So I would like to focus on this, and I want to draw from a wonderful seminar that I recently heard by a devotee named His Grace Radhika Raman Prabhu. Some of you know Radhika Raman Prabhu. He's a wonderful scholar, both a professor in the university, but also a Vaishnava scholar within our tradition. And he has given so many practical talks on implementing bhakti in our lives. So one of these seminars that he gave was on the art of forgiveness. So I'm drawing very heavily from that in whatever I'll share today. And anything good that you get from what I share, please give credit to Radhika Raman Prabhu. Like scholars, you have to always cite your work. You have to have like footnotes. So otherwise you get in trouble for plagiarizing. So this is my citation. Footnote, Radhika Raman Prabhu. Please, you can YouTube that seminar. All credit goes to him. If anything I said is inappropriate or if there's any shortcoming or I get anything wrong, that's my addition to what Radhika Raman wrote. So don't blame him. So all credit to him, no blame to him. Agreed? Okay. I want to draw from Radhika Raman Prabhu's seminar. He gave a very long seminar. I want to just touch on two things. One is why. Why is seeking forgiveness such an essential part of what it means to be a Vaishnav? We'll touch on that briefly. And then the second thing, which I hope we'll have a little bit more time for, is how. How practically, how we should seek forgiveness. Because it's easy to say, oh, just apologize, say sorry. Sorry is a very easy word to say. But to actually, in our own, according to our own Vaishnav Siddhant, according to the Bhagavat, and the examples given in the Bhagavatam, how to actually seek forgiveness in an effective way. Okay? So we'll start with why. So maybe we can have some reflections. So why do you think, or why have you understood that seeking forgiveness is so essential for everyone, but especially for Vaishnavas? You can just raise your hand and the mic will come. We'll take Lalita Madhavi Mataji first and then Prabhuji.
Hi, Krishna Prabhuji. So Krishna loves his devotees. Like you said, he's very simple. And one thing he cannot tolerate is aparat to his or offending his devotees. So once you commit that aparad, you can see the downfall in your own bhakti.
Yeah. So one reason that seeking forgiveness is so important, and we're going to talk about this, is the devotee is so dear to Krishna that it pains Krishna. And if you want to relieve that pain, I'm just putting in slightly different words, if you want to relieve that pain, then we have to seek forgiveness from the one we offended. Just like I'm a parent. If even inadvertently, if you do something to hurt my daughter, I will destroy you. No, just kidding. But the parent has that bhav sometime, right? That they're so protective over their child. But so there's one aspect that there's the fear of the parent, but also it hurts the parent. So if you care about me and inadvertently you've done something to hurt my daughter, I will only really feel satisfied when you've gone and repaired that damage. So that's one aspect. Another, I think, Prabhuji, over here.
It is somewhat related to that. I once heard from a senior that if we can't forgive another Vaishnava, how can we expect Krishna to forgive us?
Yes, beautiful point. So this is another point, that what is the nature of Krishna? One of the qualities of Krishna is that he is supremely forgiving. But if we can't learn to forgive others, especially those who are closest to us, right? They say charity begins at home. So ultimately, we want to be forgiving towards everyone, but if we can't forgive those closest to us, then how can we reciprocate with Krishna's supreme forgiving nature? Beautiful point. Any others? We'll take a couple more. Yeah, maybe two here and then one here.
Hare Krishna. It also makes us humble, whether from our side the fault is maybe there or not. But when we ask forgiveness, then it makes us humble, that we are lower, we are in the position of servants.
Yes, beautiful. Thank you. Whatever the other person may or may not accept the apology, whatever the situation is, right? Part of the thing that's very tricky is, for most of us, there are very few situations where it's completely easy to say one-sided, this person's fault, that person's faultless. Among Vaishnavas especially, usually there's some misunderstanding, some fault is shared. But we can't control the other, but from our side, when we apologize, we're engaging in a practice of making ourselves humble, which is actually, anyway, our constitutional position. Thank you.
Actually, mistakes are bound to happen, it's said, to err is human. Similarly, forgiveness is as essential.
Yeah. Okay. So if the mistakes are inevitable, the flip side of that is that forgiveness is also essential, or...
Begging forgiveness.
Forgiveness, yeah. Thank you. I think we'll take one more.
Hare This in reference with Shubh Vilas Prabhu. He mentioned like one time he was giving Bhagavatam class and there's whole description of the genealogy, the parentage and everything, ancestry. So he was mentioning that actually there's a connection and there's a flow of energy that goes on. So he particularly mentioned that towards the end when Lord Ram had come back, so Dasharatha, although he had left his body, he made his appearance to him in his astral body. So there was a blockage of energy between Lord Ram and Dasharatha Maharaj. Mm. So forgiving, he was begging for his forgiveness, which he couldn't, he was in complete struggle that time when he had mentioned and completely out of, sticking to his words. So there was a big block of energy between Lord Ram and Dasharatha Maharaj. So he had asked for forgiveness, and it's a different thing that he forgives, and that perspective he was bringing in explanation of the genealogy in those, parentage and others, that was, he gave a perspective.
Amazing point. So on a subtle level, we may not be able to perceive it grossly or see it, it's nothing you can, but on a subtle level, there are blocks. And those energy blocks, is particularly in relationships between Vaishnavas, those energy blocks, as Prabhupada says so strongly, our entire spiritual life can collapse. Such a strong statement, right? So to clear those blocks, how do we clear those blocks? By seeking forgiveness. And as Prabhupada notes, Maharaj Rahugna's glory is that he didn't wait, he very quickly did it. As soon as he realized, as soon as he came to his senses, right? So I just want to share, there's so many stories, but I want to share two stories from the Bhagavatam. They're very well-known stories, so we won't go into detail, maybe. But there's two stories from the Bhagavatam that, to me, I feel like offer us two very different pictures of, but the same ultimate message, of the need to seek forgiveness. And so let's look at these two illustrations from the Bhagavatam, and let's see what happens when a Vaishnav or anyone for that matter, very quickly asks for forgiveness, and what happens when they don't. So the first story is a story of Jay and Vijay. So Jay and Vijay were the doorkeepers of, in Vaikuntha, which gate? Which gate number? The seventh gate. And how many gates are there? Seven. So that means Jay and Vijay were the most, you can say, confidential, entrusted doorkeepers, isn't it? If you see someone's like the president, the person who's closest to them, that the bodyguards or the ministers, whatever, who are closest to them, that means their position is very high, but it also means their job is very difficult. First gate is difficult. Actually, all the gates are dying. What do I know about being a doorkeeper of Vaikuntha? But we can do relatively, the seventh gate, just the last point before someone is having darshan of Lord Narayan. So what an amazing position, but how difficult was their service, their seva. And an illustration of this is that one fine day, that who shows up at the seventh gate after passing, without any problem through six gates, who shows up at the seventh gate? The four Kumaras. And the four Kumaras are wearing, trick question, nothing. They're wearing the directions, they're wearing the winds, they're wearing nothing. And they're unknown at this point to Jay and Vijay. They're unknown in Vaikuntha. So Jay and Vijay stop them. And of course it's a long story, and many of us already know the story. I invite you, if you're not familiar with it, please do look it up. But essentially Jay and Vijay stop them. And these four Kumaras immediately, like almost, you can say, without thinking, viscerally, they just get very angry and they curse Jay and Vijay. They say, you are introducing duality into a place that's free of duality. You're introducing discrimination into a place that's non-discriminatory. You're introducing material conception into a spiritual place. Better you go down to earth and do this. So heavy curse for someone who's in Vaikuntha. So now, what do Jay and Vijay do? According to the Bhagavatam, they don't explain themselves. They don't make excuses. They don't say, hey, look, who are you anyway? What do they do? they immediately recognize we've made a huge mistake, and they immediately fall down at the feet of the four Kumaras and beg forgiveness. Srila Prabhupada, in a purport in this section, he says something really interesting. He says that Jay and Vijay's mistake was accidental. And how do we know? What is the proof that it was accidental? Does anyone know? Because anyone can say it was accidental. What is the proof? That they immediately sought forgiveness. When it's truly accidental, as soon as we come to know of it, either internally or someone points it out, just like simple example, if you're going somewhere and you bump into someone and it's actually an accident, immediately, even without thinking, oh, so sorry. I don't know if they do that in Mumbai trains, because you would be saying sorry throughout the whole train journey probably. But usually, if you bump into someone, if you're too close to someone, you say sorry, because no problem. But if there's something that's actually calculated, then it's not so easy to say sorry. So Prabhupada says, the way that we can know that the mistake was accidental is that they immediately repented. But you know who was even quicker than the Jay and Vijay? Was the Lord. Because as soon as this happened, Narayan left his asana and he immediately came there. And the Bhagavatam tells us, how do we know how immediately he came? How does Vishnu usually travel somewhere? This time, he came first and Garuda is coming after. And the Lord just put one arm on Garuda. So why did he put one arm? He wanted to tell him, it's okay, you tried, but this time I was quicker than you. But I still appreciate your service. Second way we know how quickly the Lord came. What was the Lord wearing on his feet? Nothing. He wasn't wearing his fancy shoes. He wasn't wearing his casual shoes. He wasn't wearing any shoes. Why wasn't he wearing shoes? He didn't want to waste even a second putting on shoes. It takes maybe, you know, half a millisecond or something. He didn't want to waste time. That's one reason. Another reason? Anyone know? What were the four Kumaras looking for that brought them to Vaikuntha? The fragrance of the tulsi. And where is the tulsi? So Krishna, Vishnu just thought that this is what brought these four Kumaras, but now they've gotten sidetracked, they've gotten angry, so let me just quickly give them what they came for and they'll return to their senses. And in fact, that's what happens. The four Kumaras, they have darshan of the Lord, their anger immediately dissipates, and now what do the four Kumaras do? They are feeling so much repentance and seeking forgiveness from Jay and Vijay. And what does the Lord say to the four Kumaras? This is really amazing. And then we'll go on. What does he say? The Lord seeks forgiveness from them. He says that my servants have committed an offense, but actually because they're in my service, the offense is actually mine. And he says, what can I do to make this right? If it will help you, I will cut off two of my arms. So Jay and Vijay are like two arms of the Lord. And the Lord says, I'm willing to cut off my arms. So many lessons. We don't have that much time, but so many lessons we can learn. Again, situations are not one-sided. In this story, who is actually at fault? It's really difficult to say. In fact, it's so difficult to say that the acharyas don't agree on it. The acharyas transcendentally debate this point. Transcendentally because everything is, all of them are right, all their perspectives are right. Vallabhacharya and in our tradition, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they indicate that mainly the fault was the four Kumaras. Because they were unqualified. They were maybe qualified to pass through six gates, but they were unqualified to pass through the seventh gate because they had not yet conquered anger. And also because they were a little proud of their jnana, and they were not in the mood of bhakti, so they actually were at fault, or mainly at fault. But also in our tradition, Sridhar Swami and others, Prabhupada also repeats this in his purports. In certain parts of his purports, Prabhupada includes both. But Sridhar Swami says that Jay and Vijay were at fault, mainly at fault. Why? It's really sweet. You know what he says? He says, because they needed to be more tolerant of children. Sometimes a child is crying in the class and the speaker gets very disturbed, or the other devotees. Sometimes more than the speaker, the other devotees get disturbed. And at least in America, I don't know if they do that here, but in America, there's a certain move that some devotees, forgive me, especially brahmacharis, are known to do when a baby is crying. The move is the whiplash turn of the neck to see, who is that baby that's crying? But babies cry. Children, when they get upset. So Sridhar Swami says, what did Jay and Vijay expect? You have four naked boys. When naked boys get upset, they're going to throw a tantrum. So we can't fault them for their anger. But Jay and Vijay, they should have been more understanding, more tolerant. So both are there. It also this pastime also shows us that even in devotee communities, even in Vaikuntha, there's going to be disagreements. The question is not, sometimes we come to an organization like ISKCON or a community like the Eco Village and we think, no more disagreements, no more conflicts. And then we're in for a very rude awakening. There's going to be conflicts. Sometimes there's more conflicts even when we're living in close quarters or serving in close quarters. The question is not whether there's conflict. The question is, how do we respond and recover from that? From that conflict. And then, of course, the lesson that we can learn is, in this story, who takes responsibility? Everyone takes responsibility. That's what's so beautiful. Everyone takes responsibility for their own actions. Everyone takes responsibility for the harm that was caused. Everyone is ready to fall at the feet and seek forgiveness. Now there's another story, there's so many, but there's another story that has a very different flavor, at least at first, and that is the story of Durvas Muni and Ambarish Maharaj. So Durvas Muni has what we might politely call an overreaction. Ambarish Maharaj is trying his level best. He finds a creative solution to a difficult situation, which, practically speaking, who can fault him for? But Durvas Muni actually completely overreacts. Not just throws a tantrum, not just curses, but creates like a demon to just destroy Ambarish Maharaj. For what? For drinking a little water. To break a, how long, month-long fast or something? Even longer. Year-long. Year-long Ekadashi. So what does Ambarish Maharaj do? Ambarish Maharaj really is peaceful. But how does the Lord respond in this case? He sends Sudarshan Chakra. And Sudarshan Chakra just dispatches that creature that was created, but Sudarshan Chakra is not done. Sudarshan Chakra starts chasing Durvas. So now it's very interesting. At this point in the story, what does Durvas Muni do? He's being chased by Sudarshan Chakra. He's running around to everyone. And he's going to everyone in creation, in the universe. He's going to everyone and he's saying, help me, I'm a sadhu, I'm innocent, I didn't do anything. There's some problem, some misunderstanding. Just you help me, give me shelter. So don't we do that sometimes? There's some situation. We're at fault. We overreacted. We don't want to admit it. We're not able to admit it. So what do? We go here and there. We tell our side of the story. Oh, Ram Vijay Prabhu, you know what happened? I did like this and that. This person actually did like this. And they totally misunderstood me. And so, you know, you understand me. And in the process, we spread the misunderstandings. We spread the tension. We spread all of that farther and farther and farther, right? It's not helping anyone, really. It maybe helps our ego, soothes our ego. It's okay. You didn't do anything that bad, Durvas. It's okay. But it doesn't actually solve the problem. The Sudarshan Chakra keeps following. So maybe a literal Sudarshan Chakra is not following us. But it's very interesting. Radhika Raman Prabhu, I really appreciate his point. He makes this point, very subtle point. Sudarshan Chakra, in the material world, its manifestation is time, the wheel of time. And the wheel of time is itself just an externalized manifestation of Paramatma. So there's a connection between Sudarshan Chakra, time, and Paramatma. And Paramatma we commonly understand as one of the functions of Paramatma is like the voice of conscience within us. So that Sudarshan Chakra, in the form of our conscience, our burning conscience, is following us. It's chasing us. It doesn't allow us to rest. It doesn't allow us to sleep. Maybe it doesn't even allow us to eat properly. And we're trying to somehow just, if I can just get rid of that guilt, that, because we know inside we did something wrong. We know something's not right. We're just trying to cover it over this way or that way. But it doesn't actually work. Durvasa Muni finally arrives where? To Lord Vishnu. And what does Lord Vishnu say? He said, I'm powerless to help you even. What do you mean you're powerless? You sent the Sudarshan Chakra. It's your chakra. Call it back. I'm powerless. I'm powerless because the solution that you're seeking, Durvas, my dear Durvas, you were seeking the solution by going higher and higher and higher. Brahma, okay, Brahma didn't work. Shiva didn't work. Okay, come to Narayan. But actually, the solution to your problem is down, 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 down. Go back down. Go to where Ambarish Maharaj is still waiting and go down to his feet and seek forgiveness. And that's what Durvasa Muni does. Now, when Durvasa Muni does that, he pays his dandavat. So when you offer dandavat pranam, what kind of position are you in? It's the most vulnerable position, actually, from a material standpoint. You're laying flat down. You can't see what's going on around you. You have no, can't hold on to anything. You can't, right? You can't guard, protect yourself. Durvasa Muni didn't know. For all he knew, Ambarish Maharaj could have just taken the opportunity and gotten his revenge and just smashed his head or something. But that's what's required. When we seek forgiveness, we have to make ourselves that vulnerable. I'm going to make myself... The other person may accept, may not accept. The other person can use it as a way to blast us. They can broadcast. We can apologize. They can broadcast to everyone what we, you know, our faults, our shortcomings. But we have to take that risk because we trust Krishna. If Krishna is pleased, Krishna is protecting. Okay, that was longer than I intended. So I'm going to just go very quickly through the how. So that was the why. We can talk so much more about it, but that's just a little taste of the why. But now, how? How do we actually, according to the Bhagavatam, because each story of the Bhagavatam is teaching us, and if you notice, there's repetition in the Bhagavatam. Do you ever notice that all the prayers in the Bhagavatam, they're very different prayers, but they all follow a very similar framework, similar template, right? That's not a coincidence, or that's not like, you know, laziness on the part of Vyasadeva or something. It's not cut and paste. That's intentional because that is actually, there's a process, there's a method. So similarly, there's a method when you see great personalities who have done something regrettable and they come to their senses, whether it's Maharaj Rahuguna, whether it's Indra, whether it's Brahma, whether it's Daksha, you see this pattern. So again, Radhika Raman Prabhu very kindly identified 4 steps towards seeking forgiveness according to the Bhagavatam or drawing from the Bhagavatam. And I'll just tell you the 4 steps now and then we'll go through, maybe I'll try to go through quickly each step. The 4 steps, if you'd like to note this down, first is genuinely appreciating the other, which may seem counterintuitive. I've come to apologize. I've not come to, you know, glorify and sing stutis, but it makes perfect sense why that's the first step. So first step, genuinely appreciate the other. Second step, make an actual statement of apology. And we can unpack that. There's 3 components to that actual apology. But I say actual because there's a difference between an actual apology and an apology in name, like a politician's apology. Sometimes politicians are very famous. Something happens, they're caught or whatever, they have to make an apology. But they make this apology in such a way that it's very hollow, that's not a real apology. So making an actual statement of apology. Third, to reflect, to actually introspect and reflect and to feel genuine remorse. And we'll talk about why that's different than just a statement of apology. So there's an external and an internal. And then the fourth, which we're going to see, we haven't seen it so much yet in this chapter, but coming in the next chapter, there is a commitment to change. So Maharaj Jarhugana has just come to his senses and he's just apologized. Now in the next chapter, we'll see how the whole dynamic of that relationship will change. And there's a transformation that happens. So that fourth thing is a transformation, a commitment to transform. So first, genuine appreciation. The relationship has been wounded in some way. It needs to be repaired. It needs to be healed. The soil needs to be softened. How is that soil softened? It's softened through genuine appreciation, not flattery, but genuine appreciation. You see this in the pastime of Daksha and Shiva. Daksha actually, before he gets to the heart of his apology, he appreciates Lord Shiva like anything. What was Daksha doing earlier in the whole Leela that caused this whole mess? He was blaspheming, he was insulting Shiva in so many ways, which actually, according to our acharyas, he was indirectly praising Shiva, because this was a Leela that actually helps us, enhances our appreciation for Shankar Bhagavan, for Lord Shiva. But at least superficially, Daksha was insulting Shiva, so he reverses that, he appreciates. Indra, if you see, before Indra actually begs forgiveness, he glorifies and appreciates Krishna. Durvas Muni, when he finally does go and he appreciates Ambarish Maharaj. He has beautiful appreciations of all devotees and specifically of Ambarish Maharaj. So one point that's very important is it has to be specific. Sometimes we appreciate, but we appreciate in a very general way. But in this case, especially because the relationship is so fragile, so wounded, it has to be specific. Why does it have to be specific? The other person should feel that this person is actually speaking to my heart, is truly understanding me, truly seeing me. When it's generic, when it's too, you know, what's the word? Too general, too superficial. It can sound like flattery, this superficial, surface-level flattery. But when it's specific, even now, if you want to compliment, if you want to appreciate someone, if someone is cooked and you want to appreciate them, tell them specifically what you like, which dish you liked best, what you liked about it. Oh, the spicing was just perfect like this. I noticed there was a little hint of methi in that dish. The person becomes so happy. Oh, you're actually really focused on my seva. Nice prasadam. Jai, Haribol, that's it. Doesn't have the same effect. So that specific appreciation. So the first thing is genuine appreciation. Second thing, a specific statement of apology. We specifically state what we're apologizing for, not just, oh, I'm sorry. Okay, that's there. But I'm sorry I did such and such. If you see, in both the case of Daksha and Indra, you see this. They actually acknowledge in words and articulate what they did. I did like this. I said this. I jumped to this conclusion. I thought you like this, but actually, right? Being specific. Without condition. So this is within that second step, making this an apology. The components are, one, it's specific. We specifically say what we did wrong. Two, no conditions. Means we don't add but. We don't add... I'm trying to think of what other. We don't add any excuses. I'm sorry I did this. By the way, let me also tell you that no. Just let that be what it is in that moment. Even if there is an explanation, it's okay. In that moment, let it be what it is. The one exception to this is that if it is helpful to actually clarify our intention, with that mood, we can do that. We can clarify intention. But that's not making an excuse. That's clarifying that I know that my behavior had this effect on you, and I take responsibility for that. And I want you to know that this was actually my intention. And then the last part of this specific apology is that if at all possible, or however it's possible, to offer to make things right. To offer some proactive okay, I did this, I'm feeling very sorry about doing this, it wasn't my intention, this was my intention, but actually my actions were like this, I was thoughtless. What can I do to make it right? Can I do this? Can I help in this way? Can I clarify this for this other person? Right? Whatever it is. Okay. Third step, so that was all part of step number two. Third step, saying the words is good, making some plan for some proactive way of healing the situation, very good. But unless and until it's coming from a place of genuine remorse, which Krishna is within our heart, it won't actually truly heal the damage that's done, and it won't actually help us to grow. Our growth towards Krishna is dependent upon our genuine feeling of remorse, to actually reflect. So we spend so much time living in the external world of our statements and our actions to others, which are also important. But equally important, if not more so, is going within and introspecting, processing, reflecting, mananam, reflecting. There's a beautiful story, of course, so many, but the story in the Bhagavatam of Parikshit Maharaj that, in one sense, gives us the Bhagavatam itself. Another very complex story, multi-sided, a lot of things going on. Parikshit Maharaj behaved in a way that he shouldn't have. Sringi behaved in a way that he shouldn't have. In a way, Parikshit Maharaj is justified. In a way, Sringi is also justified. That was his father. He's a Brahmin. He's young. He's immature. He shouldn't have done that. Parikshit Maharaj, so many sides to it, right? But what comes out in the story so beautifully is that once everyone starts realizing what happens, instead of, what usually happens when we realize what happened is we get very defensive and we start saying, okay, now I'm going to come up with my side of the story before he can come up with his side. And I'm going to make sure my side is better than his side. So if anyone asks, if a third party asks, I have my version of it. You don't understand. I was really thirsty. And this Brahmin was really rude. He was really, like, you should have seen him. His face, he just had such an ugly look of just, you know, and he just didn't even notice. And, no, but this guy was, he was so, this, he put this dead snake. It was so rude of him to do this. And, you know, I think he actually maybe was secretly, you know, he wasn't hungry or thirsty at all. I think he just had a grudge against my father. He just, we come with, no, they didn't do any of that. What did they do? They didn't come up with their own fanciful stories. They felt such remorse. What did I do? How was I so? It's described that even Sringi, who in some ways we all kind of like to look at Sringi as like kind of the villain of the story in some ways. He's maybe the least sympathetic to us. But Sringi cries such piteous tears. And Srila Prabhupada comments in one of the purports, he says, Sringi's crying is a sign of his sincere remorse and regret. So he weeps. Everyone feels that. So we have to take that because Krishna takes that remorse so seriously. And that fire of repentance and remorse that burns in our heart when we allow it to, when we don't let our ego wants to block it because our ego wants us to feel good superficially. So our ego is like, I don't want to do all this. It's like I'm about to go in 15 minutes. I'm about to go to the Ayurvedic clinic and I'm doing some treatment and today is a day of purging. So we don't want to do that. I don't want to feel bad. I'm dreading it. But it's so good for you. You need that. We need that. We need that poison, toxin, whatever, to be purged. Kaliya needed to vomit out poison so that he could be healed, so that situation could be resolved, so that he could be freed of what he was carrying. He was poisoning everyone because he was carrying poison. When we are lashing out at others, we're carrying poison inside of us. We're carrying toxins inside of us, spiritual toxins. So that fire of remorse is what actually purges, burns out that poisonous, you know, that poison that we're carrying, those anarthas that we're carrying. The fire of remorse for Vaishnavas especially, Krishna loves us so much. Krishna loves everyone so much, but especially those who are just trying to turn to him. He loves us so much. He's so simple, and His nature is merciful. He loves us so much. He doesn't want us to go through the slow process of letting karma take care of us. No, just burn it up through the fire of repentance. And He loves us so much that He arranges that that remorse, not just that it burns the sinful reaction that is awaiting us for our actions, but it actually burns away the, you can say, ignorant consciousness that causes. Srila Rupa Goswami explains this very scientifically in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. It burns away the very consciousness that causes us to commit sinful activity, that causes us to commit offenses. That is, but it has to come from us. Our part is we have to genuinely feel that remorse. And the fourth is that there has to be a commitment to change, even if it's just subtle. If you look at in the Leela of Jagai and Madai, they beg forgiveness and they're forgiven through the mercy of Lord Nityananda. They're forgiven by Gauranga Mahaprabhu. But, or I should say, and there is that statement that from this day forward. It's not that just, okay, no change. From this day forward, now firm commitment and resolve to be changed, to be different, right? Not to go back and do the same patterns and same apology and then pattern and then go back and apology and then go back, go apology and go back. That Srila Rupa Goswami compares to the bathing of an elephant who bathes very nicely and then goes and immediately just puts all the dirt and dust back on. So where was the bath? It's an analogy. We're not blaming elephants, but for us, we should take a little bit. We should be a little bit more committed to making that change. So I think I have a few more points, but we're running short on time. So I just want to end with just one final reflection, that it seems so simple. We have these four steps. Now you have these four steps also. You can see me later. I can give them to you if you don't have anything to jot them down with. It seems so simple, so straightforward. So what keeps us from doing it? Even when we know we've heard this so many times, we've read these, you can quote shloka after shloka of these same pastimes. But all of us collectively, I'm not singling anyone out, why is it so hard? Why is it so difficult? Why does it feel so painful, like that Ayurvedic panchakarma treatment? Why does it feel so painful to have to humble ourselves and apologize and sincerely seek forgiveness? Why is it so difficult? Does anyone have any thoughts? So the ego is such a, it creates such a block, isn't it? That ego is so, so strong. So there's ego. What else? So for ego, by the way, I mean, it's a big subject, but that's a big part of why so much of our practice, so much of all spiritual practices, not just actually Vaishnavas or Gaudiya Vaishnavas, but every genuine spiritual path, in some way, shape, or form, there is a sadhana, a practice to gently or vigorously in different ways, but either way, it's chipping away at that ego and shifting us back to our identification with the true self. Other than ego, what else? What additional? Anyone have any other thoughts about what keeps us? So envy, right? There's still some envy there, right? Those especially that sometimes we're, envy is so interesting. Envy and appreciation are like, you know, there's like a hair's difference between them. They're so close. So sometimes if we're just on this side of it, it's actually the person that we can appreciate the most, because there's something in them that just brings it out of us, right? There's something in them that we want, that we see ourselves aspiring towards, or that there's some reason that it just triggers us in a way that may not even trigger the devotee next to us. The devotee next to us may be fine. Okay, yeah, he's good, whatever. But that, something of that particular person, just like anything, makes me so envious. And if I have to seek forgiveness from that person, it's like the biggest pain. But it's also the greatest opportunity to grow, because I can actually appreciate that person. If I can cross over from envy into appreciation, I can probably appreciate that person like no one else because my consciousness is so much focused on their qualities, on what they have, right?
Hare Krishna, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we all agree that the root cause is envy in all situations. But then the bitterness and the feeling of that deep emotional pain, it rekindles. And that with all this type of philosophical understanding, we may externally keep a distance and behave and tolerate. But to be, you know, to have that type of emotion where you cry out for correction and you warned us that you carry on like this, you're not going to grow. So I'm just, because you asked it, what are the challenges, difficulties to overcome? I think the trauma, the experience which is very difficult to forget.
Yes.
You can forgive what we say, but the memory,
yes,
it's not so easy.
Yeah. That's such a wonderful point. Thank you. You know, there's this word, bhaya. So bhaya is usually translated as fear. Actually, it's a very deep thing. And I think in certain contexts, I think the word trauma is very appropriate. That's a big, big part of what can either hold us back or even if we can go through some of the, as Adhikesha Prabhu pointed out, even if we can go through the forgiving, at least motions, forgetting. And on that deeper sense, it's not so easy. That trauma remains, that impression remains. And so much of it is rooted in that kind of like that deep, almost existential fear. When this happens, and practically speaking, it happens with all of us, this is where, and I think maybe we'll close with this in the interest of time, but this is where it becomes really, really important and even essential to rely on the help of others and particularly of those who are in positions to be mediators. If you look at the story, for instance, of Indra, how does Indra seek forgiveness from Krishna? Indra must have been terrified. Like, I cannot even begin to imagine. I mean, he tried to drown all of Vrindavan, Krishna's cows, calves, his best friends, right? Sometimes we make light of it, we do a drama, and it's like, oh, rain. I mean, this is like a serious thing. And he comes to his senses, and he must have been so terrified. What did Indra do? Took shelter of Surbhi. Who's Surbhi? She's? Krishna's dearmost cow. So Surbhi is very interesting because Surbhi is someone who was known to a party that was known to both sides. Known to Indra, because where does Surbhi come from? The churning, right? Her heavenly side, you can say, makes Indra feel like, okay, she can understand me. We're kind of from the same. She's a cow. It's Krishna's beloved cow. So Indra, in this case, very intelligently, took shelter of Surbhi. And in some places it's described that when Indra approaches Krishna, he's actually holding on to the tail of Surbhi and walking behind Surbhi. So this idea of the intervention of others. Now, in this case, you know, Indra's fear was more because he knew what he had done. But in other cases, it may be that because it's so complex, we may have done something, the other person may have done something to us, we may be going to ask for forgiveness from them. Chances are they're going to ask forgiveness from us. They may or may not. We don't know that. We may be thinking, if I ask forgiveness and they don't ask forgiveness, what happens? If I ask forgiveness, and if, as a result of that, there's some consequence for me, if it gets spread everywhere that, look, he must be the guilty party because he asked forgiveness, So the other Prabhu is innocent. He must, so many things might be going through. So there's, it's so complicated. And we have our own past experiences of being burnt, being hurt by others. There's a whole flip side of this, which we didn't even talk about, which is accepting apologies and forgiving others, because it's not, right? So there's that. So there's so much going on. But if we can have the intervention of other trusted devotees who can act as mediators, well-wishers, who can give us perspective. Sometimes we're so close to something. If I'm so close, like, I'm so close, especially when I have my glasses on, to the book, that it just blurs. I can't read. So I need some distance. Then you can read. Sometimes we need distance. So others, our Gurujan, senior devotees, even our peers, but who can be objective, who can be truly objective. We have to be very honest with ourselves and not just get, like they say, echo chambers, not just create an echo chamber, that I have my best friends who will anyway just support whatever I say, and so they're just going to, like, you know, gas me up. No, to actually have real objective well-wishers who can intervene in the situation and who can actually help that healing process to happen, right? Similarly, Brahma does that for Daksha and Shiva. And there's so many examples like that. So if we can do that, and of course, if we can trust, it's a tall order. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying I'm there. I'm speaking 99% to myself right now, about to purge in a physical sense. Hopefully this can be an experience that can help me to reflect on how I can work on the many anarthas that I need to work on as well, including the ability to actually seek forgiveness. So I'm really speaking to myself here. But if we can just remind ourselves again and again and again that when we seek forgiveness, even though it's scary, even though we have the trauma, even though our ego is screaming at us, don't do it, even though our envy is burning, whatever it may be, but if we can just remind ourselves we are not alone in this, that Krishna is there. Krishna is so pleased when we even try to seek forgiveness. What to speak if we try to seek forgiveness from a fellow Vaishnava, aspiring Vaishnava. Krishna is so pleased. Won't he protect us? Won't he care for us? Won't he have our back, as they say in America? Won't he have our back? Won't he protect us? That whatever else happens, Krishna is pleased. And when Krishna is pleased, right? Sam siddhir haritoshanam. What more do we? What more could we ask for? So I know it's a tall order, and we're all at various places. It's a work in progress, but hopefully these are some thoughts and reflections that can help us as we, in our own lives, encounter these kinds of situations, like Maharaj Rahuguna did, and realize that for our own growth and for the repairing these fractured relationships, that we need to seek forgiveness. So with that, I want to seek your forgiveness for going a good 15 minutes solidly over time. I've not left time for a question and answer, but I hope I can... See, this is a bad apology because I'm modifying by saying but. I have not left time for questions and answers, and I'm very sorry about that. I'm also appreciative that we did have an opportunity for some devotees to share. And I'm happy to speak with anyone one-on-one after this class or even later in the week. I'm here for some time. So thank you so much. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Shilaprabhupada ki, Rahuguna Maharaj ki.